Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our midweek Bible class time here at Watermill on this Wednesday evening. Hope you guys are doing well. We hope your family is doing well. We look forward to the opportunities that are before us this summer, at least in our prayers, and hopefully in our plans as well. It is weird, isn't it, how your schedule can be interrupted and you're not getting to do the things that ordinarily we think of doing, and yet you feel caught up in a whirlwind almost because you're still busy. If that ever happens to you, if you ever feel that way, then our class tonight is going to be especially thought-provoking and applicable in our lives. We have a great passage from our Bible reading together here at Watermill from one day this week, and we look forward to our study in just a few moments. I know this is a time when all the school stuff is winding down and when changes are taking place in people's work lives and the things that we have responsibilities for, the things that we are doing in our families. And our prayers are with everybody through all of this. And we hope that you will remember our family in your prayers, but also please remember this family of God's people with your prayers each day as well. And especially think of our elders with the responsibilities that they have and to helping to care for us and helping to chart a course for us going forward. And I know they will appreciate being remembered. Tonight we're glad that the Hatfields are here in town for a couple of days this week. They brought some of their things. And Justin is here with us tonight. And we asked him to say a few words to us if he'd like, but to lead us in our prayer to begin with tonight. John Ewing is going to help us in a song, and then we'll have a prayer, and then another song, and then we'll get into our Bible class time tonight. Thank you again for being with us. Thanks, John and Justin. Be still. Have you said that to anyone recently? What did you mean when you said that to a child or to someone else around? Be still and know. That's a different way of thinking about this, and it means something different. Be still and know that I am God. That's a far more meaningful statement yet. It's Psalm 46. Psalm 46 was in our Bible reading yesterday as in our congregation's life. Psalm 46 is a beautiful, beautiful song that everyone who's in this class tonight will have heard read at one occasion or another in one situation or another. I wrote the notes for our study tonight, and I first put, this is the song that everybody loves. I've seen it in commercials. I've seen it in public service announcements. I've seen it read in devotional situations. I've seen it read or heard it read or read it in very tender family situations with people whom I have loved. When I wrote the phrase, I thought to myself after a while, it's not good enough. I should have said the song everybody loves and needs. And I could have gone ahead and said, and need so badly, or need so often, or need so much. If you think about the way this phrase, be still and know that I am God, appears in this song. If you think about the way this song begins, God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Then you have to say, there is, first off, a statement or a saying that is making a claim, maybe even expressing a confession. There is a fortress. Our little grandson's running through the hall a few minutes ago at home carrying both ends of a long blanket. And when we ask where they're headed, the answer is we're building a fort. We're building a fort in the hall. Have you ever built a fortress? Have you ever needed a fortress? That's somewhere you go for what? For safety or for protection or for well-being. So it's wonderful to hear the claim there is a fortress that will do, a fortress that will stand, a fortress that will keep us. But you know, when you think about that statement, there is an implication. What's implied is that there are troubles in life. That there are times when a refuge or a fortress means something because it is so much needed. And there are always, for people who believe God or not, there are always various kinds of troubles to be phrased. Or to be faced. I brought with me tonight a song that you'll be familiar with that is a paraphrase of Psalm 46. This song touches four centuries. It was written by Martin Luther in the 16th century. It's set to a tune from somebody else in the 18th century. It's translated from German into English by somebody else in the 19th century, and it's read in Arkansas language by me in the 21st century. Here in this song, notice the way Luther begins by stating the troubles for which a mighty fortress will be so much appreciated. He says, "A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark, a fortress, never failing. Our helper He amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing." That's a foreboding phrase, but of mortal ills prevailing. That's our troubles. Why? "For still our ancient foe doth seek to work us woe. His craft and power are great, and armed with cruel hate. On earth is not His equal." I'm sure not, are you? And if we're not His equal, then we need a fortress. And Psalm 46 says, "A mighty fortress is our God." That was Luther's way of expressing the message. This psalm, I want to tell you before we start reading through it, is built around a great chorus. Like what we just sang, "O Zion, lovely Zion." There's a chorus in this song, Zion being the place where God meets His people or dwells among His people. The chorus in this song is stated in verses 7 and 11, and then in a little bit different phrasing, the same message begins it in verse 1. "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress." You can see we're not talking about a physical fortress here. We're talking about being in the Lord's keeping. Think about the phrases that are used of God here. He is the Lord of hosts. That means He's the living God who leads the armies of heaven. He is powerful in that way. He's the God of Jacob. This is the faithful covenant-keeping God who made promises to the fathers and then has been faithful to them all along. And then He's God with us. Emmanuel would be the way we would be more familiar with it. Because of this, the song says, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble." Refuge is somewhere you go for safety. Strength is something that helps you to face the challenges you have. And trouble is what you experience because you're alive in this world. I noticed that the ESV suggests that an alternate way of saying a very present help is a well-proved help in trouble. A lot of people for a long time have made it through because they've been with God and God's been with them and strengthened them. So that's the confession that Psalm 46 embraces. We are people who believe that God is our refuge and our strength and a well-proved help in trouble. So let's explore the way the psalm expresses it. We'll do it kind of there are three equal parts to this, and we'll do it a part at a time. And I need to say before we read this, this is a song or a poem. It's meant to really engrave a message on our emotions. The message being, God is our refuge and our strength. God is our fortress. So the images used here and the language used here are meant to really impact how we feel. So while we read this, imagine yourself in this situation. Imagine this going on around you. And think about what the emotional impact of it is, how you feel. Some of you will be able to identify with this well. There are three parts to it. One deals with how it feels to be as if the natural world is just coming apart around you. Another part of it is how it feels when you feel like the nations of the world are coming down on you. And the other part is how it feels when God steps in and speaks in this situation. Okay, let's start with the first three verses. Watch while I read these verses for the word though, T-H-O-U-G-H. It's repeated four times, and we understand it to mean even though, or even when, and then watch for the earth, the mountains, and the waters of the sea. The earth is, of course, this world. The mountain is the strongest thing in it. The waters of the sea, the most fearful thing to the people who live then, especially the depths of the sea. And then think of the earth and the mountains giving way or being moved or trembling under some great ferocious power attacking them. And then hear the water, feel the water overwhelming, the roar, the foam, and the swelling up of huge giant waves attacking or bringing destruction. Here's the way it says it. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Now think about this. Fear is an emotion. You could not possibly face what we've just been describing in a kind of a here's where we're headed way without feeling fear. It's not saying we are completely dead to emotion because we believe in God. It's saying instead we're not going to take any action that would give up our loyalty to God. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea. Can you imagine that? Here's a huge, mighty-looking mountain. All of a sudden it just sinks in the sea. That would be completely fearful on its own. Though its waters roar and foam, that's the sea, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. How much does it take to make you so overwhelmed by fear that you think about just giving up? How much does it take? If you're like me, less than a mountain sinking in the sea, and less than the trembling of the entire created order around you, and less than the feeling that the cosmos is coming apart from its natural order. And yet, in some ways, what we've been going through is like that, isn't it? Have any of you ever seen or been through anything like this before? No. Therefore, we have a place in this picture. The question is whether our confession is something that we can hold fast to the point that fear doesn't take over and conquer us. This is saying the people of God will not fear. The people of God have a therefore in their lives, which is that God is their refuge and their strength and a very present help. Therefore, we're not overcome by the fear that could otherwise overpower us. Now that's the natural order, but that's not the only foe or the only place where we feel the pressures of life. The next has to do with the world of people and the world of nations. And in this case, this psalm says that the people or the city of God will be glad. Notice the complete opposite of fear. And notice the different way of our speaking of the city of the people of God. The city of God, the place where God dwells among his people. We think Old Testament terms of Jerusalem or Zion. We think of New Testament terms, the presence of God with the people that he's purchased for his own possession. The city of God will be glad. Here's what it says. There is a river. You think about Egypt had a great river. The Assyrians had a great river. Zion had no river. So the river we're talking about here must be a way of understanding the blessings that flow into the people's lives because of the presence of God in their midst. You'll see it here. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. I think it's important here to start with the contrast to the previous statement where the waters were roaring and foaming and swelling. Now then, the nations rage and the kingdoms totter. But it says there is a river, though, that makes the city of God glad. Notice the contrast. Same language as used in the natural order is now used in the order of the world, national order of the world, but the city of God is made glad by a stream that flows from the throne of God. That's how we're to understand it, I think. God is there, so this city won't be moved. Even though all this other stuff, either naturally or internationally, is pressing down on the lives of the people, they're not moved. They're not overcome by fear because the God of Jacob is there. Third, God will help her, help this city when morning dawns. That's a lovely thought, isn't it? That there would be morning. God will help her when morning dawns, verse 5 says. How will God help her? Well, the next verse says, while these nations rage and the kingdoms totter, he utters his voice and earth melts. Just his word. Earth melts. It melts is an interesting way of thinking of everything calming down and being quiet. God uttered his voice and earth melts. I want to pause for just a moment from our psalm and ask all of you Bible readers to think of a time when there would be an actual case in point where this happens. The nations rage. It looks like the city is cut off. It looks like the people of God will be destroyed. There's a case in point when Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, just after 700 BC, comes and surrounds Jerusalem. Sennacherib was the most mighty ruler in the world at that time. A few years earlier, he had conquered the northern kingdom and carried the people away completely, resettled the northern kingdom with foreigners. Then, 20 years or so later, Hezekiah becomes king in Judah. And Hezekiah leads a great spiritual revival where he casts off idolatry and where he renews faithful service to the Lord, the God of Jacob, in Jerusalem. And as a part of that, Hezekiah rebelled against Sennacherib. Sennacherib had been allowing Israel to exist because a whole bunch of the treasures and so forth from the temple had already been taken and carried off by the Assyrians. That was allowed to happen by Ahaz, who was the king of Judah in Jerusalem at the time. Hezekiah had only been king 4 years. He was only about 29 years old, and he rebelled. And here came the Assyrians. They could not let it go on, because to find out, for anybody else to hear that someone had successfully rebelled against him, would threaten his grip of power on the world at that time that these people lived in. So he comes in great threatening numbers and surrounds the city. Hezekiah tries to make peace with him, and the king of Assyria requires 36,500 pounds of silver and 3,650 pounds of gold. An overwhelming amount. Hezekiah had to completely strip everything else in the temple to try to pay it, and it still wasn't enough. So the king of Assyria sent his officer to speak, cry out in the language of the people of Jerusalem who were able to hear him, threatening, ridiculing the idea that they could trust in the God that Hezekiah was asking them to trust in, and that he had been be able to deliver them. He threatened them. He engaged in psychological warfare against them very effectively. Hezekiah just told the people not to answer. And Hezekiah went and prayed, and he prayed fervently for God to act. And God sent Isaiah to him and told him not to be afraid. The Assyrian officers continued their ridicule and made preparation after appropriately threatening Hezekiah. They made preparation to attack the people in Jerusalem the next day and to completely destroy it. God, however, tells Hezekiah that this is the word of the Lord concerning the king of Assyria. She despises you, she scorns you, she wags her head at you, Jerusalem. Do not fear. And he goes ahead to say, he shall not come into this city, or shoot an arrow there, or come before it with the shield, or cast up the siege mound against it. But by the way he came, by that same way he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, declare the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. That night, just before morning, at dawn, they looked out from Jerusalem, and they found that the angel of the Lord had struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And the Assyrians had gone home at a word spoken by the God who dwelled in the midst of the people in that city. That's a very vivid way of understanding. I'm not saying that this psalm is necessarily about that, but it sure could have been. That's the situation where this happens. So we go back now to our outline of the psalm with that in mind. The people of God will not fear. The city of God will be glad, Psalm 46 says. And then the work of God will be known. This is verses 8 to 11. This, in some ways, is the really thought-provoking part of this wonderful psalm. This is really a summons to the nations, or an invitation, if you will, to the nations. Here, for the first time in this story, God actually speaks into this situation. It says, come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. And here's the quote from God: "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." End of quote. And now the people: "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress." If you can imagine that spoken into a situation where the people inside the city had realized their total powerlessness and their complete dependence on the help of God, and God helped them. And then, standing there looking out at the remains of the Assyrian camp, "Everybody come and behold the works of the Lord among all the nations of the earth. Come and stare at it a while and realize that God makes wars cease. Wars are their own disaster because they destroy those who engage them. There's never anything good about that kind of destruction." One writer that I read observed about this: if you think about this, literally speaking, it is a breathtaking view of history. The other option is to read it as if it's a spiritual in meaning that the evil one gets overcome. But in this case, the idea is that the God who is our fortress actually controls, that He's the one who maintains the rule in the world He made. Eventually, that truth comes out. Everybody come and take a look. And then there's the statement in verse 10, which looks different to me against this background: "Be still." I read it like it's telling me to calm down from my busyness and my worry and my anxiety. If I hear it spoken to the nations, if I hear it spoken to the one who makes war, if I hear it spoken where there has been raging and tottering, then I hear God taking control. The different translations of this are interesting. I think the New American Standard says, "Cease striving." The American Standard Version offers the possibility that it could be translated, "Let be." In other words, let the will of the Lord be done. One possibility is just to say, "Enough! Enough of the roaring, enough of the raging," and so forth that goes on. And then God's statement of fact: I will be exalted. I am the one who's in the highest place. Eventually, the knowledge of me will cover the earth like the waters that cover the sea. That's the great hope of the Old Testament prophets. That's what we pray for when we pray, "Your kingdom come, your will be done." God is God. That God is our refuge and our strength. The God with us idea started with that movable tent, that tabernacle in the wilderness where God went with His people. It became the place where God put His name at the temple in Jerusalem, where He would dwell with them in their presence. It becomes eventually God with us, Emmanuel, in the form of Jesus Christ, the person who dwelt among us and in whom we could see the glory of God Himself. One writer makes this statement. I thought it's thought-provoking. Psalm 46 is not about an impregnable city of God, a metropolis of security founded in the world to exempt its inhabitants from the dangers of history. Its true subject is the God who will help the people in whose midst He has chosen to be. That temple is His dwelling. The song does not invite us to trust in a place, but in a presence who wills to dwell with people. In Jesus, that invitation to come and behold the works of God turns into, come unto me, all you who are laboring heavy laden, and I will help you be still. Another way of saying the same thing. God's people, like Abraham, look for a city which has foundations, whose builder and designer is God. The Hebrew writer says that in Hebrews 11 and verse 10. In Hebrews 13, verse 14, he says, we don't have here any lasting city, but we seek that which is to come, like Abraham did. And the wonderful announcement of the gospel is that city is yours and mine if we'll have it. We look forward to the time when the dwelling place of God is with man, and when all of His people dwell in His presence. We thank Him for Psalm 46. Be still and know that I am God. Thank you for studying with us tonight. John will have another song and then the announcements and the prayer.